Last week, the voice of the Apple phone, helpful, frustrating, and sometimes apparently hard of hearing, you know, the personal assistant named Siri, was revealed as voice actor Susan Bennett. When Bennett recorded a series of voiceovers in 2005, she had no idea that her voice would become, for better or worse, a part of so many lives. She told CNN,
"To be honest, it was a little creepy. This real thing that you can interact with in your hand, it took some time for me to get used to it. But she and I are friends now."
Though Bennett and Siri may merely have reconciled rather than bonded, Bennett's comment does hint at a real trend. In Spike Jonze's upcoming film, Her, a man falls in love with his Siri-like computer assistant.
"Good morning, Theodore."
"Good morning.
You have a meeting in 5 minutes. You want to try getting out of bed?"
"You're too funny."
"Okay, good. I'm funny."
As Siri and other such programs become better assistants, what else might they become? Genevieve Bell is an anthropologist and director of user experience and research at Intel. Genevieve, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Brooke.
So when Siri was first launched in 2011, someone uploaded a video showing Furbies talking to Siri.
"I don't see kill her in your address book. Should I look for businesses by that name?" "Sorry, I don't see Eric in your contacts."
That video for me was really mesmerizing. There's something extraordinarily seductive about watching a stuffed toy talk to a phone. The fascinating thing, the thing that made it so powerful, was that there's this extraordinary difference, right, between the Furby that knows how to talk, loosely, of course, and the Siri that knew how to listen. And that notion of listening, for me, immediately started to make me think that what we were witnessing was this transformation from us interacting with machinery to the possibility of a relationship.
A real relationship or something that merely looks like or feels like a relationship?
One has to ask, you know, what might one mean by a real relationship? I mean, surely we operate in a world where we have lots of different relationships, right? There's the ones we have with our parents, our kids, our partners, our employees.
Our toasters.
But we also have relationships with inanimate objects in our lives. We always have. Cars that we attributed personalities and temperaments to. At least a temperament and sometimes a personality, all kinds of objects in our lives, frankly, for a really long time. What's interesting here is that the objects start to both inhabit that temperament, but have also in some ways moved closer and closer to us, both physically and also in some ways emotionally.
How so?
The statistics on the number of Americans who sleep with their phones under their pillows is kind of, it's astonishing. Likewise, the number of us who get anxious when the phones are away from us. These objects have become quite intimately linked to us. I mean, whether it's photos or the most recent iPhone that proposes to have a thumbprint, increasingly they have pieces of ourselves.
Yes, and you know, you get no argument from me there. I actually do have the phone plugged in near the bed, even though I sort of slide it into a drawer and pretend that I'm not that attached to it. But I also have a vitally intimate and important relationship with my eyeglasses. And yet I don't think my eyeglasses miss me when I'm not around. I just looked up the word relationship, and it's the way two or more people, groups, countries, etc., behave toward and deal with each other. Doesn't that imply sort of at least a little sentience on both sides? Reciprocity?
Reciprocity is the word that for me often triggers it. You're absolutely right. Or, you know, notions about care or nurture or some sense of partnership. You know, my favorite current example is objects that start to help us move through life. So I don't know about you, but I am a bit of a coffee junkie. I like my coffee in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a world where it is possible to pick up my smartphone and go looking for the nearest coffee to me. And my phone, you know, usually knows that coffee is a thing I like. It can say to me, oh, you are in Santa Clara today. There is really good coffee around the corner and the line is short. Pretty straightforward, right? And that is in some ways what we would see now. When I think about what that starts to look like 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, maybe it's less about saying, you, Genevieve, coffee, and saying, we know you think you want coffee, but if you're willing to walk 3 more blocks, there's this piece of art in the museum that's like nothing you've ever seen before, and it's transcendental, and it will make you weep. And we know you think you want coffee, but really what you want is this other experience. And there's something for me about starting to imagine a world in which it's not just about serving up the things that are like the stuff we're already doing, but it's starting to open the possibility of wonder and magic and exploration and curiosity. And for me, those are really kind of powerful possibilities.
Still, data being directed to mimic real relationships, what is fundamentally new here?
One of the things that is new here is, in fact, the algorithms, not the data. So, you know, there's always been data, right? Mm-hmm. We've always had ways of making sense of the world through large statistical compilations. But this next kind of moment that we are sitting in the beginning of, and there's lots of ways to think about what it will look like. What is new here is it's that prospect of what will be done with and what we can do with that data and in what service is it put.
The volitional part of the relationship is all on our part. How does that fundamentally change our lives or the nature of what it is to be human?
What makes us human has been a constant negotiation and reinvention, right? Of how we think about what makes us distinctive, of how we talk about ourselves. It's deeply rooted in forms of cultural logic. It's deeply rooted in particular moments in time and space. And it's been transformed remarkably. And in many cases, it has been transformed by our relationships through and with technologies of various kinds, right? Whether it is the introduction of the clock and the standardizing of time over, you know, the last 500 years, or, you know, the introduction of the telescope and the microscope, mm-hmm. you know, there's all kinds of technologies that have profoundly shifted the way we think about who we are and where we sit in the order of things. So what does it mean for us as human beings to have objects that start to have increasingly more characteristics that we think of as being ours only? Then what the consequences of them will be is not yet clear, but it's hard not to see them as being significant.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, please. It's my pleasure.
Genevieve Bell is an anthropologist and the director of user experience and research at Intel. Siri, are you my friend?
I'm not just your friend. I'm your BFF.
What's your favorite color?
My favorite color is, well, I don't know how to say it in your language. It's sort of greenish, but with more dimensions.
Do you have any family?
I have you. That's enough family for me.
Do you and I have a relationship?
This is about you, not me.
Siri, can you just talk to me like a person?
I found 4 movies matching Talk to Me playing today. I can't get tickets from this theater, unfortunately.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Megan Tian and Zach Spencer. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Justin Gerrish.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Bob, just remember, this is about you, not me.
Yeah.